hello, everyone. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival. I'm Alyssa Gershowitz, editor-in-chief of The Horn Book. We are a children's book review journal based in Boston, and we're about to turn 100 years old next year.
Woo! Woo! Thanks.
We have a booth outside at the festival if you want to stop by and say hi and learn more about us. So, first question is, are you having fun today?
Yes.
Second question, who here loves Halloween? Okay. Who loves spooky books?
Some.
I get scared easily.
Neat. See, that's me not, too. You did
your
not see my hand go up.
Your book really scared me.
So that, who loves books that are spooky but not too spooky? Because
me.
That is me. So these three wonderful authors have written books that are mostly in that last spooky but not too spooky category. But be warned that that last book at the end does have some
pretty scary,
maybe the lights on kind of thing. So I'm going to introduce each author, then each person will describe their book and then read a little bit from it. Then I'll ask some questions and then you all can ask some questions. And then at the end, all the authors are going to leave through the children's room and they'll be signing out in the front. So let's get started. Sierra Birch is the author of Finch House, published by McElderry Books. She holds a BA from American University and an MFA from Emerson College. Boston Book Festival adult readers might remember her short story, Yvonne, which was the 2019 One City, One Story read. If you go to Sierra's website, the tagline is writer, reader, ice cream lover. So you know we'll be talking about ice cream later on. Welcome, Sierra.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Davies is the author of The International House of Dereliction, published by Clarion Books. You might know her Lemonade War series, her Sydney and Taylor books, Nothing But Trouble, or many others. Her author bio says, she is a well-behaved adult now, but when she was a child, she would occasionally get into trouble.
I have two sisters and a mother who attest to that.
So we'll talk about that later, too. Welcome, Jacqueline. Susan Tan's book is Ghosts, Toast, and Other Hazards, published by Roaring Brook Press. She has written the award-winning Cilla Lee Jenkins books and the Pets Rule early reader series. She went to Williams College in Massachusetts, and then earned her PhD from the University of Cambridge, not in Massachusetts, where she studied children's literature, and she teaches at UMass Boston. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Would you like to go first to read from your book?
Oh, yes. Wait, so I should describe what it's about and
yes.
then read? Okay, sorry. I'm very bad at following the instructions, apparently. So, hi, everybody. It's so great to see you here. So I'm Susan Tan, and this is my book, Ghosts, Toasts, and Other Hazards. So quick pitch of this book. This is a book about Mo, who is 12 years old. She has a lot of anxiety. So she's kind of the person who's always like, oh, don't run too fast, you'll fall, right? Or I just want to keep everyone safe. And Mo has had to move to a new house following a kind of upheaval in her family. So she's moved in with her great uncle Ray, who is a self-described aging Chinese hippie, who is based on my father, who's sitting there in the front row. He said it was okay. So Mo moves in with her great uncle Ray, and she's like, I just want to keep my family safe. I don't want to make new friends in this new town. We're just going to like keep our heads down, and it's going to be fine. And then she comes to believe that her backyard is haunted by the ghost of an 100-year-old circus elephant, which is not safe and a really big problem. And so she has to set out to solve this mystery. And as she does, she maybe has to make some friends and be a little bit brave. So that is what this book is about. And I'll just read to you from the first few pages. Okay. Chapter 1. Toast is a slippery slope. I am not afraid of toast, just to be clear. I am afraid of fires, though, which can be caused by everyday appliances like toasters. So toast isn't the problem, but you could say it's the start of a slippery slope. Since the move, I've been eating oatmeal for breakfast. A lot more than my breakfast has changed since we lost our house. Don't worry, it's not as dramatic as it sounds. We have a place to live. It's just that now we live with my great uncle. It's temporary, my mom says, until we get back on our feet. but I don't know how she plans to do that, since she spends most of her time either job hunting or in bed with the door closed. And that's not mentioning the stacks of bills and letters from lawyers on the kitchen table that she never opens. So I think we'll be here for a while. Here, somewhere at the opposite end of on your feet. But Uncle Ray's house isn't so bad. Like always, I'm making the best of things. Take our rooms, for example. At our old house, I always had my own bedroom. But now I share with Cece, her little sister, in a small room upstairs that used to be Uncle Ray's study. It's a nice room, but it's cramped, and when I first walked in and saw the two twin beds with a narrow space between them, I knew I could find a better solution. Uncle Ray's old study has a long walk-in closet, and on our first day here, I claimed it. And no, I don't mean that I put all my stuff in there. I mean I put myself in there. It turned out it was big enough to fit. 1, a twin mattress if you lay it on the floor. 2, a small bookshelf. 3, a lamp to go on top of said bookshelf. So, the closet is my bedroom. It's perfect. Cece has her bed in the corner, along with a giant basket filled with her stuffed animals. Meanwhile, I have privacy and the space of my own. The arrangement is pretty perfect, or would be, if it wasn't for the whole fire thing. Because if the house burns down at night, will a firefighter really think to look in the closet? This occurred to me on my second night here, and I knew it was something that had to be dealt with. So after some worrying, I came up with a solution. The next day, I took a piece of paper and wrote, "Attention, firefighters. There are 4 people in this house and 1 annoying chihuahua. Please rescue us all." I taped it to the front door until we could get a more permanent side made, but Mom made me take it down. So I've taped my note up on the sliding closet door. Also, I sleep with the closet door partially open, so if there's a fire, I'll hopefully hear the commotion and get saved along with everybody else. And I think that's about 2 minutes. I'll stop there. And I should just say, the closet story is a real life story. So I don't know. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that later. But yeah. Anyway.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
Okay. So can I ask you to hold
oh,
that?
Oh, of course.
If I desperately need it.
Oh, I can hold it. Oh.
We should have worked this out ahead of time. So. All right, back to this, International House of Dereliction. So this is a book about a 10-year-old girl named Alice who's a very independent person. You'll meet her mother and her father in the first bit that I read. But she is unschooled, which means that she is in charge of her own learning. So her parents, her mother's a professor at the local college, her father's a building inspector, they go off to work each day, and she is left to decide what she wants to learn about that day. So she studies all kinds of things. I mean, architecture and science and history. She reads Henry David Thoreau. She reads poetry. And every night her parents say, "What did you learn today?" And she fills them in on all the things that she learned. And so when they move to a new house, for the 11th time in her 10-year life, they're moving to a new house. She's interested in the house next door, and you'll hear a little bit about that in the part that I read. So I'm going to read the first 2 paragraphs just so you're introduced to the characters. Then I'm going to skip a couple of pages so that you can see when she goes into the house for the first time. Chapter 1. Alice's mother owned a podium. This was not the strangest thing she owned, but it was by far the most eye-catching. The podium dominated the living room. All the other furniture seemed to bow down before it. Even the fireplace, which you would think would assert itself as the hearth of the home, crouched humbly, weighted down by dozens of framed photographs of the family on both sides. The Cannolis, Alice's mother's family, were all extraordinarily tall and thin and shaped like bendy straws with legs. The Pochniks, Alice's father's family, were all short and round and rather hairy, resembling happy bears who had eaten their fill of honey. Alice, who was just 10 and still becoming who she would be, had gotten the best from both gene pools. She was smart and fearless like her mother, and good-natured and a whiz at fixing things like her father. But whether she would develop a laugh as loud as a Pochnik or learn to do a backbend like a Cannoli still remained to be seen. She was, after all, very much her own person. And as her mother often said, time will tell. So now I'm going to jump ahead. They're moving into their new house, which is a modest little run-down brick house. But Alice keeps being called to the house next door, which is a very elegant mansion that is completely dilapidated. It has been abandoned for decades, and in fact, it's condemned. There's a big orange neon condemned sign, and so the whole house is locked, and she can't get in. But she keeps feeling like something is calling her over there. So while her parents rush into their new house to figure that all out, she kind of wanders over to the other house. And she's already gone around it once to discover that every way in is locked. Alice walked around the house again, this time paying attention to the bulkhead door that led to the cellar. The door was locked with a rusted padlock, but when Alice yanked on the wooden handle, the whole thing came off in her hands. Another invitation? It was as if the house were saying to Alice, "It's about time you showed up." The door opened onto a coal chute. Alice flicked on the flashlight that came with her all-purpose tool and shined the light down the dark hole. She could see clear to the floor of the cellar. The distance was no more than 7 feet, so she slipped her legs into the small opening and lowered herself down the chute, dropping the last 3 feet into the empty coal bin. She scrambled over the wooden side, feeling a splinter pierce the flesh of her index finger. "Ow!" she said as she landed with a gentle thud on the soft dirt floor. The cellar was dark. Alice stretched her index finger into the shaft of light that fell through the open bulkhead door and used the tweezers from her utility tool to pull the splinter from under her skin. A single drop of blood, ruby red and thick, welled up from the spot and fell from her finger. When it hit the sandy dry floor, it disappeared, as if swallowed up by the house itself. Alice bent down and shined her flashlight beam where the red droplet had landed, but there wasn't so much as a mark to show that blood had been spilled. Alice put her tool in her pocket and looked around. In the dim light, she could see the octopus arms of an ancient coal-burning furnace and the stairs that led to the first floor of the house. The rest of the cellar was bare, except for the wooden stalls along one wall that had once held all manner of things needed to run a house of this size. Chopped wood, blocks of ice, root vegetables, coal. Alice poked her head into a few of the bins, but they were empty. The air in the basement was cool and slightly damp, but not musty. As she stood still, Alice could again feel a steady heartbeat, this time through the soles of her feet. She knelt down and put both palms on the smooth floor. A spider dropped down on a thin strand of silk and dangled in front of her face, seeming to watch her. Alice held her breath, feeling the pulsing in her hands, and now she knew this heartbeat wasn't her own. "Hello?" she whispered again, but the house didn't respond. The spider quickly retreated up the silk path it had spun. I'll stop there. Ooh. Thanks.
Sierra.
My turn.
Yeah.
I was engrossed. Yeah. Okay. Finch House is an about 11-year-old girl named Micah. She's very curious, and she's also lived with her mom and her grandfather for her entire life, but she's moving, just her and her mom, so she won't get to be with her grandfather full-time anymore, unfortunately. And there's also this house called Finch House that she's not supposed to go to. Her grandfather has very explicitly warned her to stay away. And because Micah is who she is, she does not. but only because her grandfather goes missing and she has a feeling that maybe he might be in Finch House. So I'm not actually going to start on the first chapter or the first page. I'm going to start at chapter 6 when Micah is already inside of the house. Okay. There was nothing creepy about the attic in the middle of the day, except for the fact that it was an attic. It didn't look like much more than storage space. Dark beams crisscrossed the ceiling, low enough in places that Micah had to duck, and pink puffs of what looked like foam were everywhere. "It's supposed to keep it warm up here," Theo had explained, "but it doesn't really work." Micah agreed. It wasn't just cold like Theo had said. It was freezing, as cold as if they were standing by the open front door. She'd nearly wanted to turn back around and grab her coat, but then he'd shown her the door, and she hadn't stopped looking at it since. It wasn't much, almost identical to the one downstairs, except this one was completely smooth, lacking even a keyhole. Micah bent down and pressed along the seams of the door, hoping it would swing open like in the movies. She sighed when it didn't. "Maybe it's not a door," she suggested. "Maybe it's just wires or something back there." Theo nodded, but he looked unconvinced. He lingered by the door to the hallway, like he was ready to flee at any moment. I guess, but I... But what? He sighed. I've heard stuff coming from back there. My mom says it's just pipes, but it sounds like voices sometimes. Like how you can hear people talking through a wall. The cold intensified. It tickled along the back of Micah's neck and down her spine. Do you hear that only up here? No. He met her gaze. He looked a little worried, but mostly stubborn, like he was waiting for her to call him a liar. It's like the dark. It's everywhere. But it's always louder closer to these doors. I asked Renee if she's heard it too, but all she does is laugh or ignore me. Ghosts. Neither of them said it out loud, but it was impossible not to think it. The house had been abandoned for years. The people who'd gone missing inside of it abandoned too. Nobody liked being forgotten. Maybe not even old houses and dead people. Micah sat down with a heavy sigh and rested her back against the door. Theo sat beside her. It was warm against her back, warmer than the rest of the attic, at least. She tried to hear the hum of wires or the whisper of voices, but everything was silent. She tilted her head back, stared up at the crisscross ceiling. I think, she began, when she heard a creak. They froze. Micah and Theo locked gazes. If the door creaked again, she couldn't hear it over the heavy beating of her heart. It raced even faster as she slowly leaned forward, off the door. It followed her as she did, the creak stretching into a low whine as the door swung slowly open behind her. It was only a few inches, but it was enough. Enough to make a decision. Enough to push it open further. I'm going to stop there.
Doesn't that make you want to read all of those books with the lights on or off, depending how you like to read? My first question to you all is, what is it about spooky stuff that draws people in? Susan?
Ooh, I love this question. I love spooky stories, and I'm a late comer to like loving spooky things. Like I never used to, and now I watch scary movies, and I love ghost stories. And for me, I think it's because like I think there's something kind of fun like about being scared, and especially when you know at the end there's going to be some kind of resolution, like, or some people kind of call it catharsis, right? You're scared, but then you're like, oh, okay, but that's not real, right? And everything was all right, and they left the haunted house, and I, like, kind of got to get those emotions out. Maybe I feel a little better. So for me, I love the way spooky stories make me feel, and I feel like they draw me in this sensory way into a story. So that's what I love. And I just think, too, there's something so cool, kind of scary, but cool about the idea that like here is our real world, but maybe some places in it like have memories or have like there's so much history everywhere, and maybe some of it is like alive in a certain way. And I think that can be a really cool, exciting idea. So I think that's what I would say.
I'm kind of an interesting person to answer this question because I don't like spooky things. I mean, I've watched two frightening movies in my entire life, and I still haven't gotten over them, Carrie and The Blair Witch Project. And it's like, I cannot watch scary movies, and I don't read a lot of spooky books. But I think that regardless, we read books because we want to feel. We want to feel something. And what is more kind of visceral, gets you right in the gut, than something that scares you? I think the tricky thing is that... we all have different lines that we walk up to, right? We all want to get right up to that line and then no farther. And so I think it's important to make sure that we titrate our scariness to our personalities. This is a book that actually, it did not start out having ghosts in it at all. There was a house with a presence. I knew that. Didn't know whether it was benevolent or malevolent. And in fact, it turns out to be a mixture. It's an odd, almost unsolvable mixture of both helpfulness and hindrance in the house. But she walked into this house and there were ghosts there. And so then it became a ghost story. I did not start out to write a ghost story. So I'm not the one to necessarily say why people want to watch terrifying movies.
But you are.
I'm actually pretty easily scared too, but I was always a big like Goosebumps fan as a kid, and I would always be reading. I was supposed to be asleep, but I was definitely under the covers, like with a flashlight. And I think like the appeal, I think you guys have both already said it really well. It's just, you know, it's sort of reading in any sort of media is an escape from your own actual life. And I don't know if there are ghosts in our real life, but it's fun to think that they can be in our fiction and everything that they sort of represent. And just, it's fun to be scared too, especially like you said, when you know it's going to turn out okay in the end and you're not the one in danger. It's the character. I think that's a lot of the
fun.
Kind of
heartless of you.
They're totally fine at the end. They're happy. They're safe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Maybe.
Pulling the strings. So all three of your books feature haunted houses or structures or places.
Yeah, we were talking about that. It's like, what is that?
Yeah, so the common themes I found are haunted places and complicated family dynamics. Very complicated, I would say, in all of your books.
Yeah.
And historical elements. So how did each of you get to these three themes that you all end up having in common?
I'll jump in first about the house, because the house was the beginning of the story for me. Mm-hmm. Even before it was, well before it was a scary story, there was something about writing about a house that was sentient, that had a presence, that had a will, that wanted to exert its will. I thought it was fascinating the way you turned the physical embodiment of that into a person of a sort. I kept mine as the house. So the house doesn't talk, the house doesn't move, but the house causes air to move and causes things to drop. And so it was this idea of a sentient house. And where that came from, for me, was thinking about how much shelter means to me, like what home means to me. I've lived, after moving around almost as many times as Alice, not quite as many times as Alice when I was young, I've been in the same house for 30 years. That's longer than I've lived anywhere. If you took all the other houses together, that's longer than I've lived anywhere. So there was a period about 10 years ago where I was going through a really tough time, and going out into the world was a challenge for me. Going out and being around people, going to school visits, even going to the grocery store, it was just hard for me because I was going through such a difficult emotional time. But coming home, I was home. And so that feeling of the house wrapping itself around me and protecting me was something that I wanted to explore. Well, once you get into that area of a house being alive, what's the house going to do? So it starts to be a little bit creepy. There's something a little bit creepy about it. But it started from this place of feeling sheltered and protected. And that stays through the book. I mean, the house is sheltering and protecting. You just don't know exactly who it's sheltering and protecting and who it's fighting in order to shelter and protect others. So I started with the house, is what I'm saying.
I also started with the house, but mostly because I think Victorian houses are very interesting. I've never been inside one, and I've never lived in one. And I mostly have lived in apartments my whole life. And so I think just the idea of a house in general was always very fascinating to me. Like, okay, everything's not in this one, like, floor where you can just easily, like, you know, walk to your mom's room or to the bathroom. You have to go up, like, stairs in Victorian houses, and there are attics and basements. And my pop-up does live in a house. He lives, like, in a row house. And he has this basement that is terrifying. There's nothing down there. It's just the concept of it. You know, you look right down the doorway and it's just dark and there's stairs and we're never allowed to close the door. Like, it always has to stay open for some reason. And that's always just been fascinating to me. Like, I've been down there 100 times. But the thought of, like, okay, there's nothing down here, but what if there was? And why is it down there? And why is it scary? Especially in an older house, which I think are already sort of creepy by default, just because, you know, they've been around a long time, longer than you, longer than your parents. And it's just, like, what does this house have to say if it could talk because it is so old?
And you think about all the lives that were lived
exactly,
there. And the people that died there, people
right.
who were born, the people who died, lives were lived there. That's why old houses.
And that's fun. And that's like sort of where the ghosts come in.
Yeah.
And also the idea of history. It's just like this house has lived through so much and so many different iterations. And maybe it's been renovated and maybe it hasn't. And like, how does it feel about those renovations if a house can feel? And that sort of led me to, okay, I want to explore this.
And has it trapped anyone inside of it lately?
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Susan?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about a lot of these things too. And it's funny because in my book, it's less of a haunted house story in that there is a kind of haunted house, but it's not necessarily the house Mo lives in. So there's like this other house that she finds. But what I think is funny is, so for me, it actually started out as a more like as a haunted house story. I was like, she's going to be in the house. There's going to be like something in the house. And I actually thought, I set out to be like, I'm going to write a really scary story. Like maybe it'll be YA. I want it to be so scary. And I just think I have a really middle grade voice. And I just think I realized my voice because I was immediately like, and then there was a ghost and it was an elephant and it was kind of cool and maybe a little friendly. And then I was like, okay, this is not the scariest, like the story that came out was not the one I thought I was writing. But I think, I also think a lot about homes. And yeah, like as a kid, I moved around a lot. And I also had some situations, right, where outside things would happen and home, that place that you want to be like so safe and stable, mm-hmm, right, changes in ways that can feel really destabilizing and kind of scary. So I think I thought a lot about that and kind of home as a metaphor for like maybe, and sometimes when things are scary or hard, it's hard to give them, you know, to give them words and to talk about it. And so for Mo, I was like, what if this ghost kind of becomes the way that she can talk about it, right? Like she doesn't know how to talk about her own feelings and what she needs, but she can talk about what this ghost character is feeling or might need. So,
I'm just thinking about something you just said. There's a built-in tension when you take something like home, which has these warm feelings, and then you twist it.
Yeah.
And you say, no, this place is scary. You don't know what's going on here. So as an author, some of the work is done for us because
that's true.
To do that creates attention, which is great for reading.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you all, how do you keep track of the houses, the homes, the settings? Do you sketch them out? Because everything is very clearly described and you can picture, part of what is so creepy is you can picture yourself in those spaces walking through. How do you all keep track of that while you're writing?
Yeah. Well, so I had a sort of floor plan that I found online of like just a Victorian house. And I sort of adjusted it for my uses. But it's also helpful for me that Finch House sort of changes while you're inside. It doesn't stay the same. So it kind of felt like cheating because it's like, okay, I forgot about this room. It doesn't matter. It doesn't exist in this side. So I think the main rooms that stay the same are like the turret in the basement because they are like the most important places. But yeah, I had a floor plan that was very helpful. My editor was also really helpful.
Yes. Thank God for copy editors who catch all
like,
our mistakes.
You made this
wasn't the living room this? Wasn't it morning just 2 minutes ago?
I thought you could see into the kitchen.
Right.
The dining room, and you're like, oh
my
right.
God. The things they notice and remember, you're like,
honestly,
I made this up. How are you remembering any of this?
Go on.
I laughed when you asked that question because I needed a lot of help. So the house that Mo lives in was based on a house I lived in. So that was easy.
Oh, that helps.
And it was really easy. And Mo lives on the Old Town Junkyard, or she lives right next to it. And as a kid, I actually lived in a house that had been on the Old Town Junkyard. So a lot of the stuff, like the soil is always shifting and stuff comes up, and that I had all experienced. So, and it was really cool. You found like little treasures in your yard. Oh. So all of that was from memory, but the house they go to, this old colonial haunted house, I felt like if you ever watch those home renovation shows, you know, where they're like, it would be lovely to have a kitchen with large windows where we could all gather. I felt like my editor and I were doing that in the process because she'd be like, I think we need another kind of spooky scene. What if there was a room in between the rooms you've already described and it was like a parlor, so there was a desk there? And it was like this constant kind of home renovation thing, which was, and so it took a lot of like mapping to do. But I also think that it was such a cool reminder of what we can do as writers because, you know, it's like as the writer, you're in charge, but also every little detail and setting can help further your story. So it's really cool to get to say, oh yeah, actually like there, what if we do have this living room, which we have to do for plot, but actually a living room is where family spends most of their time or a lot of their time. So if that place is really scary, that kind of amps up the scariness and the metaphor and the idea of what the characters are dealing with even more. So I struggled a lot with it, but it was really fun too. Yeah.
Every time I start a new book, I start a new spiral-bound blank book. And I just put everything in there, including drawings, maps, what the house looks like. I decided early on that mine was going to be Georgian. I originally thought Victorian, but then I thought, oh, I've loved Victorian houses my whole life. Time for me to do something different. So Georgian it is. And one of the features of Georgian houses are windows called eyebrow dormers, you know, up in the attic. So it's like got these, it looks like an eyebrow. It really does look like an eyebrow. And so it started to look like eyes. So what I did was, because I love research, I would rather be doing research than writing. I could keep doing research forever and never start writing. I found tons. I mean, I'd look through hundreds and hundreds and came up with about 15 photographs that I blew up. just not able to handle this. Blew up and stuck up on my bedroom wall. And so every morning I would wake up, and in those first hours before I was really even, you know, getting conscious, I would just see this house. The staircase, the living room, the fireplace, these all became really important features in the book. So I had a Georgian house. It wasn't a single Georgian house, but it was, a collection of them that created a cohesive idea for me. When I walk in to this house, I go up the stairs to the left. And so that's what helped me keep everything in place, photographs and my drawings in my notebook.
Well, and do you want to describe the reason that the house the family lives in is in the state it's in? Because he has the urge to...
Oh, so he's... Okay, so this also goes to a little bit. Okay, so he's a mad fixer-upper. He's a building inspector, but his thing is that he fixes up things. Professor Cannoli teaches... She's a professor at a small college in the town where they live. And what the dean of the school has discovered is that if they keep putting this family in these... But they buy these broken... Because housing is part of her contract. It's how she's part of how she's paid. They put this family in these broken-down, dilapidated houses, and the father just gets to work on them and turns them into these gorgeous houses, which the college then sells. I think at one point they paid for the entire drama department's budget with the sale of one of their houses, and then they move them on to the next dilapidated house. And he's just like, yes, let's get to it. Now, during this whole time... I was building a little house up in Maine, actually, that's sort of a writing place for me. And it's very contemporary. But so I wasn't remodeling, but I was surrounded by the construction of a house. And I saw the bones of the house, and I saw the slab that it laid on. And I really got that sense of how a house kind of grows up. So so many times when she had to have some new project, you know, fixing the floorboards or redoing the molding or reglazing windows or something like that, I would think about, okay, what's being done at the house right now? And that would kind of feed its way in.
So at some points in the stories, children are doing things they should not be doing in all of your majorly in all of these stories. And at other times, the bad things that are happening might not have happened if the children were believed by the adults who they are talking to. So how do you balance this tension between the kids' actions and the adults' reactions in the narratives?
Oh, yeah. Happy to dive in. Yeah, you know, for me, I love that question. I think for me, that's part of the appeal of writing a supernatural story, or, you know, a story with a bit of a ghost story, because it changes the stakes a little. We're sort of still in the real world, but we're slightly removed from the real world. And because for me, I sort of love that. Like, and I don't want any parents to be like, wow, Susan Tan thinks your children should not follow directions and do things they're not supposed to do, you know. But I think that there's something really powerful and something maybe we all experience when we sort of feel like we wish we could do something, right? Or, you know, there's a situation that's wrong, right? Mo feels like Madi the elephant, that's the elephant's name. She feels like this elephant in her life was mistreated. And she's like, I want to make it better for her. I want to fix this. And I really like that the kind of ghost setting gives Mo an opportunity to be like, I'm going to take action myself, right? I'm going to fix it. I'm going to do something. And I think that can be really empowering. And for me, what's really important is, you know, exactly as you say, because if the adults had taken her seriously, then she wouldn't have to sort of do things that are not the most responsible. Do not run into old abandoned colonial houses by yourselves. That's dangerous. But I like that what's really important for me is that while my characters can like take action and take sort of do something, they also have adults who they trust and they know that they are loved and supported so that when these situations continue, you know, they sort of also know that there's someone they can turn to for help or for guidance. Even if the adults are like, oh, are you talking about something make-believe? And your character is like, no, it's real, right? But they can still get advice, right, and have support and love from those adult characters. So I think that's kind of how I balance it. So the child characters get to go out and do something and make a difference and help people or elephant ghosts in their communities, right? But then also having that foundation at home.
So you talk about your characters trusting their parents. In my book, it's a little bit of an extreme situation. Professor Cannoli and Mr. Pochnik both trust Alice completely. Like, they don't have a lot of rules for what she's not allowed to do. They respect
her. They tell her not to go in that house.
They do tell her not to go in the house.
It's condemned, for goodness sake.
They do. But other than that, she's really given a remarkable amount of leeway, which I think was one of the sort of most fun and freeing things for writing the book, because she had their trust so much, and because they just adore her. They think she is the sun and the moon. And so so there were many places that she could go. And as Susan was suggesting, as an author, you want your characters to be able to go and do things. You don't want them the way many of us are, you know, strictures and rules and all that stuff. There's something very freeing about them being able to go out and do things.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I mostly go sort of, I guess, by character personality. So Micah's a very curious girl. Like, even if someone has maybe told her not to do something, she might just poke a little. And I think it's with her, too. She's spurred on by the fact that now she feels like she has to do something because her grandfather has gone missing. Yeah. And the last place that they see his truck is outside of Finch House. And I think it's important for her to sort of weigh her options. So it's either I can break these rules and save someone that I really care about, or I can do nothing and see what happens if I do nothing. And I think it was really important to her that she not do nothing. And in sort of Micah's case, her mom is absent. She's in this house and she's stuck there, and there aren't really any adults that she has really seen there. So there is no one to keep telling her no, or to not do this, or to not go further. She just has to sort of trust her best judgment and figure out whether or not her best judgment is good or if it's bad and if it might lead her down some not great roads. And I think sort of that was important because she's already going through this big change of having to move away from her grandfather into a new town and a new house, and sort of learning to trust herself and her instincts in this sort of scary place was important, whether or not it's, you know, am I listening to an adult or not? Mm-hmm.
All right, so I do need to ask your favorite ice cream flavors before we get to audience questions. We want to make sure everybody, but I promised ice cream flavors at the beginning, so favorite ice cream flavors, everyone.
Oh, it's mint chocolate chip.
Mint chocolate chip. I'm gonna, but with oat milk, non-dairy. Oh, try it. Planet Oat mint chocolate chip.
I leave the full fat. You know, I gotta have it.
I can eat more if I don't have the full fat. That's the selling point.
I feel like an outlier because mine is chocolate and vanilla froyo. With rainbow sprinkles.
Yummy.
Right? It's like different. It's so good.
So. It's okay. We still love you.
I know.
All right. Well, who has questions for these? What was your inspiration to write the books?
Ooh. I would just say really briefly, it was that feeling of seeing what would it be like if a house came to life.
I think it was my pop-up's basement because I was always sort of creeped out by it.
And mine was some moments when I was younger. So I did have a room that was a closet. There was another room available to me, but it was downstairs, and it was the only room downstairs.
Closets are better.
Alone.
Yeah. I had a closet.
Yeah.
I had a closet.
And it was all alone, whole thing in. And I was really scared. So I made a room in my sister's closet so, like, I could be with them. But, like, it was a time when I had all these fears. So I began remembering that. And the letter Mo writes, that's the first thing I ever wrote of the book. Because I was like, oh, I wrote a letter like that when I was a kid. What was it? So it's kind of from real life. And then there was a ghost. Not from real life.
Yeah, go ahead.
So what's your inspiration for writing ghost stories?
Ooh, what's your inspiration for writing ghost stories?
Oh, that's a good. I love ghosts. I have ghost earrings. Yeah. I think they're just really fascinating to think about. And, you know, when I'm not here, will I be a ghost? I don't know. I think it's fun. And I think with ghosts, you know, you get to play sort of with history and with time. And I think that's just the fun of it. You never know if it's like actually there or not. And, you know, there's like Casper, the friendly ghost. There's all different types of ghosts.
The ghost in my book showed up unexpectedly, so it's not like I can pinpoint an inspiration. It was literally I was writing the chapter, and all of a sudden a voice said something, and I realized, ah, there's a ghost in the room. So I can't tell you where that came. Where? Somewhere deep, deep, deep inside me, that came out. But it came out without any planning or anything external that pointed me in that direction.
And I also love the idea of friendly ghosts. Like, I love looking at places that when you, as you were saying, like, as you know, they used to be lived in and there were so many people or things, and being like, what would it look like to see those people or things? And so I, as I began writing, I loved the idea of being like, oh, you learn about like something that has happened here and like maybe you can also see it and interact with it. So I love that idea.
And your ghosts are from all different eras.
They are.
My ghosts are, I've got a Revolutionary War, I've got a World War II, and I've got a 70s, you know, no nukes and say, you know, all the stuff that was in the 70s. So it's fun to have ghosts in these different time periods because then you can play with that.
Or a cool elephant.
Or a cool elephant. Yes.
She can't talk, but she's a lot of feeling.
What's your question?
Ooh, do they believe in ghosts?
I do. I like to think so.
So I adamantly did not believe in ghosts until I got into my 40s. And I had friends who did believe in ghosts, and I would listen to them, and I'd just have reached the place of, I don't know. Who am I to say whether they're a ghost or not? I don't know. So I'm very open to it. I have a feeling in my family that that perspective is not shared. I'm open to the idea of it. I don't know whether I do or not, but I came from a place of absolutely not. There are no ghosts. Isn't it your character? Your character is very like, no ghosts.
There are no ghosts. There are no ghosts.
Like, I was like, yep. I remember that.
And I do kind of believe in ghosts. Or I believe in ghosts, or I think I believe that, like, places have memories sometimes, yeah. You know? Like, so, yeah, that's kind of how I feel. So maybe another word for that is ghosts.
Yeah, that's the thing. Sure. Maybe there's, like, an idea that doesn't have to be the word ghost. That I believe in.
But it's a cool word.
It is a good word.
And they're so fun.
And it rhymes with toast.
And it rhymes with toast. Oh, thank you. Will you do publicity for me?
Thank you all so much. This was really great. We really enjoyed hearing about your spooky houses and your ghosts and your inspiration. So everyone will be going out the children's room and going to sign if you would like to get your book signed. And really, thank you all for coming. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.